Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it fair to hold people responsible for being brought to the United States without legal permission before they were old enough to make their own decisions? That is the situation for some of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States today. Because there is no citizenship requirement for children to be accepted into K-12 public schools, some of these young people only learn of their illegal status when the time comes to get a driver's license or a first job or to apply to college. Once they are aware, however, many live in fear of being relegated to second-class status by virtue of lacking a valid Social Security number, or worse, being deported back to the countries where they were born when they may no longer have any memories of living there or even fluent language skills to get by. Journalist Eileen Truax explores the shifting legal climate that affects many of these young undocumented migrants in her new book, Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Eileen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
The term dreamers has been applied in different ways to describe young immigrants. How do you define the term?
Well, in a very wide way, and just sticking to the legal description set in the DREAM Act, this piece of legislation presented in 2001, aiming to regularize the immigration status of these young people. This could be children who were brought with no documents to the U.S. at an age before 15 years old that have been in this country for at least 5 years. That would be, in general, the definition. Young people who grew up in here with no documents. I think another definition may be American young people who lack of a document that says that is that they're American. And the reason is that they have spent most of their lives here. They grew up here. They speak English. They have an American identity, American culture. So in their soul, in their daily life, they are Americans. They don't have a document saying that.
This is a very timely discussion for us to be having in Texas because the Border Security Panel of the Texas Legislature is talking today about revoking in-state tuition rates that have been available to undocumented public college students since 2001. What is your perspective on the ramifications of taking that benefit, if you want to call it that, away from immigrant students who have done well enough in school to be admitted to a state university?
I think we are at this moment trapped in a discussion that has a lot of political and even partisan tints. We are looking through that kind of lens. We listen to a lot of people from parties, from several political movements talking about this issue. It's hard to see very clear only through those lenses if we don't start thinking about this issue through the lens of social justice and human rights. To me, it's sometimes hard to understand why aren't we talking about families, aren't we talking about communities while we are discussing this. Of course, this is a legal matter. Of course, there are valid points coming from all points of view. We should consider and discuss everything. But sometimes I feel that in this discussion, we forgot that we are talking about human lives, that we are talking about children becoming your people, children that have been sitting in classrooms next to our children, our own children, children that may have been living in the same street, in the same neighborhood, children that we meet every day. This is not something that we are talking and it's real far from us and that we haven't seen. We are talking about our own communities and everything that happens inside of our communities, for good or for bad, is going to affect us as well. So to me, we have to start considering this as a whole thing, as something that has something to do with politics, with to do with economics, of course, with safety in the border, but also with human lives, our community.
You have a lot here, certainly in the book, about the shifting sands of legislative efforts to either block or facilitate the path of undocumented immigrants who arrived in childhood. But your real emphasis here is on telling stories. Can you talk about what made you take that approach rather than just a book of statistics and, you know, results as to how these people turn out depending on the laws?
Yes, Chris. Let me start talking a little bit about my own experience approaching to the subject. I'm originally from Mexico. I moved to Los Angeles 11 years ago, and I started working as a reporter for La Opinión, the largest Spanish newspaper in the country. And I was assigned to the immigration beat. When you cover immigration, and well, since you are in Texas, you also are familiar with this kind of stories, are very more common if you are close to the border or if you have a high Latino population in your communities, you normally cover what we call breaking news, right? A deportation, maybe, I don't know, an employer that has abused, certain stories that we put out there. But I start realizing that we had this story that was not told as often because it seemed to be not that relevant. Every immigrant that you interview or every immigration story that you tell has, besides a group of people, many of them children and teenagers. And what are these children and teenagers doing every day? Doing just the same that our own children, going to school, living their lives, doing their homework, maybe they're enrolled in sports team. And we tell our children, as the parents of these children tell to them as well, that if they study really hard, they can be whatever they want to be in life. You go to school, you do the right thing, and you can be whatever you want to think, you want to be. And I start realizing, as following these stories in my everyday work as a reporter, that many of these children became teenagers, finished high school, graduate from high school with honors, and at that moment of starting getting better as we teach them, well, they realize they can't. They, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, they cannot have a driver's license, they cannot go to college. I mean, they can go, but they have to pay full tuition. They don't have access to scholarships. They cannot get a job. They cannot get a life, the life we promise to them. So I realize that if we speak about legislation, if we speak about politics, if we speak about numbers, we are not being fair with these people. We have to put a face, we have to put a name, and we have to listen to their stories just in order to acknowledge how important, how relevant is for them every day. And as I mentioned in the book, how every day can become a little Everest. The simple fact of getting up in the morning, going to the school, and come back to home, for an undocumented person may be really hard because you don't have a driver's license, and either you are driving a car because you need to, or you are taking 3 or 4 or 5 buses, so it's late, you have to run. The simple fact of going to school, and maybe you just have the money for the tuition, but you don't have any money left for books or even to eat. The fact that maybe you have to run from school before your class finishes because you have to get to a job in order to keep earning money, in order to pay for that school. So every decision that you make during the day has something to do with your immigration status, an immigration status that you did not choose. So I thought that just giving a close look to these daily lives, maybe it would be easier for us to understand how hard is living as an undocumented young people that knows no other country than this one.
You write about one program in California where school administrators, university administrators, realize that they cannot extend financial aid to students who are undocumented. There are laws against that. But they can do things like provide, as you alluded to, food aid to these students who are trying to make ends meet with a collection of part-time jobs as they work through school.
Yes, this is interesting because at the beginning, this was not a program coming from school. It was a program coming from other students. And the most interesting thing for me when I discovered this is that this is happening at UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles, one of the most renowned educational institutions in our country, the one that receives the highest amount of applications every year. And to find out, and it's a beautiful school with these very fancy buildings. It's a very nice place with a lot of gardens. And it was shocking to me to discover that in the middle of one of the buildings, in the student building, there was a closet, literally a closet, that had some fast food in there, some microwave soups and maybe chips and fruit. And there were students at the beginning, people that food in there for other students. And the reason was that some undocumented students that start to make it a little bit better because maybe they solved their immigration situation or because maybe they got in a little better economic situation, realized that they were not the only ones struggling to make the ends meet during the day. There were a lot of other students in that situation in the school, and that was something that people didn't talk about. You don't share with other people your immigration status when you are in a place that you are not supposed to be. When you are an undocumented person, you learn how to hide, to disguise yourself, to not be noticed. You become a shadow, literally, because that's a way to keep yourself safe. So sometimes young people do that in colleges and universities. So other students realized that that was happening and that maybe there was a way to help. If there was a meeting going on in the next room from maybe academics or other events in the school and there was some food left, it was a good idea to put that food in that space so anyone who needed that can take it without being judged, without having to ask, or without having to pay. And this was not a program thinked with undocumented in mind. It was someone that was taught for people in need. We were talking about 2009. It was a very hard time for the whole country, so it was common to see people that maybe was just facing foreclosure or maybe the parents lose the job. So it was all kind of students in need. But they put a book, a notebook, on a table next to the food, and they invited people using that food to share their thoughts. And when I read that notebook, I noticed that many, many of the people using that space were people that really didn't have to eat, have money to eat that day because they had no documents. I'm sorry, because it was hard for them to complete their money just to cover the basic needs of their school. And some of that mentioned, if it wasn't for this, I wouldn't have it today.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Eileen Truax. Her new book is called Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. We'll resume this conversation about the Dreamers and about immigration and potential paths to citizenship for those who were brought to the U.S. without documents before they were adults in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Eileen Truax. Her new book is called Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Eileen, tell us about Mohammed Abdullahi and the kind of training that he provides for members of the Dream Activist Students Action and Resource Network.
Yes, Mohammed is a very interesting character. And the first thing that makes him interesting is that he is not Mexican or Latino. Sometimes when we speak about dreamers or even about undocumented immigration, we tend to think about people coming from Mexico or coming from Central American or other Latino countries. Mohammed Abdullahi is the leader of the National Alliance Immigration Youth. Nia is the name that they go by, and he is from Iran. He is an undocumented young person from Iran who came to the country when he was 4 years old and has lived all his life here in the U.S. And he, among other young people from different countries, has created this group that is part of the whole Dreamer movement. And I just want to mention something real quick here. When we speak about Dreamers, we are not talking about one kind of movement or one kind of people. We have seen different kind of small groups of Dreamers, both locally and as part of a national network. And some of them are a little more, I could say, by the book. They try to follow the rules in a very tight way. They try to go to Congress to lobby with their politicians, their local representatives. They try to do the best to show that they are exactly how the society expects them to be in order to have some solution to their immigration status. And then we have a vast array of the actions that these groups develop. And then we have these other groups that have opted for a little bit more radical actions. They are using civil disobedience tactics in order to get attention about their movement, about their stories, and, to have the Congress and the society to listen. Mohammed Abdullahi is part of one of these groups that are choosing the civil disobedience in order to get some attention to the movement. What do they do? They are starting from a simple idea. If you are in a vulnerable situation, like being undocumented, and you hide, you become even more vulnerable. If you put yourself out there, if you become visible, if you join to other people in your situation, if you create groups, if you speak about it and let the society to listen your story, you are less vulnerable, you become stronger, and there's a bigger chance for you to be protected. So starting from this idea, what this group is doing is to organize dreamers who are willing to share publicly their stories in order to grow awareness in society and in media about their situation. Again, to put a face and a name in a problem that has been in media just through numbers. They organize groups in cities and in states that have the most anti-immigrant environments. For example, in Alabama, when the anti-immigrant legislation was presented, or in Arizona, in the city of Phoenix, where they ended up in jail with Sheriff Arpaio. And what they do is they, in civil disobedience actions, block streets, send a message, call the media, and through that action, share the stories of their members, explaining how they are dealing with their daily lives, how they feel that they deserve an opportunity since the country has invested in their education and since the society has made them part of it, and how they have no other alternatives. The message that they're trying to send is, I'm vulnerable. Every moment of my life, I can be walking on the street or driving a car and someone can stop me and I may end deported to a country that I don't know that very same day. So what's the difference between that and stepping in here, getting arrested and risk deportation? At least this time someone is gonna look at me. So what has happened is that in the last 3 years, this organization has held around 20 or 25 of these civil disobedience actions. Dreamers have been arrested, sometimes 6, sometimes 8, sometimes 13. The number that participates on that actions varies. But what we have seen is that every time, at the end of the day, they are released by local authorities. And they are released, as I see it, because of two reasons. The first of them is that they do not represent a threat to the country. And as you know, since the Obama administration published the memo Morton that indicates that deportation processes may be directed to people who has a criminal record or represents a threat to the country, clearly a group of students are not in any of these categories, so they decide just to set them free with a bail. But also, I think the second reason is that they have created this very successful media strategy to put them out there, to put their faces and their stories in the middle of our society, and that has helped also to raise awareness and to make the authorities to think twice what's the message they want to send to their own communities.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Joyce in Houston. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, I'm on the road to Houston, so hopefully I don't drop the call. I grew up during civil rights in America and was intentionally one of the young kids who desegregated a school. We were trying to do that by nuns. And I was 14 when I had the opportunity to go to a white school and was impacted through high school and college by the same kinds of things the Dreamers go through. I paid every penny of college myself. No scholarships, none of that. But what I learned to do is vote with my dollars. Social justice is one way to get what you want, but we live in an economics-driven society. Have the Dreamers and their families thought about voting with their dollars and refuse to do business with organizations, companies, people who won't support their cause?
Thanks so much for your call. What do you know about that, Eileen?
Well, I think, as I mentioned before, there can be many strategies coming from one side of the other. I think every person has a different experience and may create a different strategy in order to help towards what they think it's fair, or the other way around, to help just to build a path that goes around people that they don't feel are doing the right thing. What I think is that we as members of a society, should we have our eyes and our ears and maybe our sensibility open to listen who is next to us? As a person who just called mentioned, they have their own experience, a personal experience, and based on that, you can make your mind and decide what's the best strategy for you in order to approach to this problem or this kind of movement. What I think is very important right now is that everyone gets the most information that they they can talk to a person. Everybody knows someone who is in the country with no documents. Talk to them. Ask them about their children. How are their children doing? What are they doing every day? What do they want to be when they grow up? To me, it has been amazing to talk to these teenagers that know that they are not going to be able, for example, to go to school unless they pay full tuition and still they are talking about becoming lawyers, becoming doctors, becoming nurses, because they want to give back to the society. That, for me, is very inspiring. So I think the clue here is just talk to someone who has a face and a name, and every person are going to find their own way to approach to the subject.
When you talk about teenagers and their parents having the talk, people's first thought might go to talking about sex. I think in a lot of African-American families, the talk is about how young men in particular should deal with interactions with the police. For the families of dreamers, the talk is sometimes the first indication these young people have that they are, in fact, not legally in the United States.
That's something that surprised me a little bit, something that you don't imagine until you are talking to them. And it's understandable. If living as an undocumented person can become a burden to an adult person, you can imagine what does that mean for a kid. So it's very understandable that parents want to protect their children, not sharing all the information about their immigration situation when they are growing up. So since many of them came to the country real young, 3-4 years old, they don't remember being part of other country or don't really know what does that mean. So they go to school, they live their regular lives, and it's just in the moment when they're trying to do something else, when they receive letters, acceptance letters from colleges or universities, and they're asking for a social security number, and they go to their parents and say, okay, where's my social security number? They realize they don't have one. And they realize, what does that mean? That means that you don't have an open door. So that can became really painful. That can became just a turn, and sometimes you don't know what to do. Let's think that when you are a teenager, you are vulnerable. You are in a very sensitive age, and you are adding on a situation like this. That's why this dream teams and these other groups of dreamers organized have become so important for some of these teenagers. It's a way, of course, to give them information. It's a way to organize them. It's a way to keep a struggle that I started a few years ago. But it's also a way to give them an identity. You are not the only one going through this situation. You are not by yourself. You are not alone. And we together are going to find a solution to this. And that part, I think, is what is giving the Dreamer Movement their heart and their strength. Let's remember that the Dream Act was first introduced in 2001. It has been sitting in Congress for these many years. It hasn't passed. The occasion... I'm sorry, a little cough. The occasion where it was closer to pass, it was in 2010. It was passed in the House, and it was 5 votes short in the Senate. And since then, nothing has happened. And Dreamers had two options at that point. They could stay as victims, just waiting for someone to do something in order to fix their situation, or they could take the matter in their hands. And I think that's what they did. They realized there was no legislation coming, but they decided that they had to do something. They started organizing not only locally, but in a national network. They started lobbying in Washington, going to the media, talking to people, sharing their stories. And this has given them a certain political power, but also this has given them identity. They feel part of something, and they have learned not to be ashamed about their own situation.
It would be reasonable to assume that college-bound students might at least find a more welcoming reception in their home countries, meaning the countries they were born in outside the United States. But you found, at least in Mexico, universities are not necessarily inclined to accept credits that students have earned in U.S. schools. Can you tell us, there's a young woman you profile named Adriana.
Yes, I have Adriana in one of the chapters, and I have Nancy Landa in another of the chapters. And their stories show how difficult it may be for them to try to start over in a country that they say is theirs. I have to mention here that around 72% of the almost 2 million dreamers in the country are from Mexico. Although we have teenagers coming from other countries, Mexico is the one that, if we want to put it that way, has the obligation, or would have the obligation with these young people when they go back there. And what that happens, what they have found, is that, first of all, they feel they don't belong. The case of Nancy Landa, it's very touching because she is a woman that came to the country when she was 9 years old with her family, undocumented. And she had a very successful university career. She graduated with honors and she started working here in the U.S. And in the age of 29, she was deported suddenly to Mexico. One morning she was driving her car to her job, and that same night she was deported back in Tijuana with just $20 and a cell phone on the pocket, knowing no one in Mexico, no family, no friends, no relatives, no one, not knowing the language and not knowing what to do. And when I talked to her and she started talking to me about her journey in order to start a new life in a place that she didn't belong to, but most important, whose society and whose government was not prepared to receive back, it was where I understood that this is more, can become more painful. That the idea that we have, because when I say to someone, go back to your country or back to your home, I'm thinking that there's actually a home or a country waiting for that person. We have learned that, at least in Mexico, the legal aid that they got, the society welcome that they receive, is not what you expect if you are supposed to be home.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Eileen Truax. Her new book is called Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Eileen Truax, who has a new book out called Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. You can get to us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And we have a tweet here from Kay who writes, though their plight breaks my heart, what about the fact that dreamers are here illegally?
Well, of course, that's the whole key around this debate. Yes, they are here with no documents. Let's remember this. Sometimes when politicians are discussing certain pieces of legislation in order to solve the immigrant status of undocumented people, they use the word amnesty. And amnesty means a forgiveness. And, of course, that's the case for people who broke the law when came to this country. And for some reason, and we know there are several reasons to do that, but there's a fact that people come here breaking the law in order to get to the country and stay here that way. But if you were brought by your parents when you were a baby or a child, legally you don't have that responsibility upon you. That's why we give free education to our children, K to 12, no matter what their immigration status is. That was a resolution coming back from the 80s when the Supreme Court discussed a case of a child from an undocumented immigrant. The resolution was that the children are not responsible for their immigration situation right now. So technically, we don't have something to forgive from the legal perspective over these children. That's why we are giving them education. What we have now is a loophole that doesn't say it. I mean, the law allows us to give them education, K to 12, but the law doesn't say what are we going to do next with these people that we already educate, that with our taxes we gave education to. So that's the whole thing. That's what the DREAM Act is trying to solve. That's what Senator Durbin, the person who presented the legislation, has tried to explain several times to the Congress. And I think it's easy to understand this point of view if you only talk to one of these young people. You are in the middle of a situation that you didn't choose, but not only that. You have grown up in a family with where some members may have an undocumented status as well. You understand the reality of your community, and you understand that you cannot separate one people from another when you are part of a family or when you are part of a community. Because the strength of this movement that I was talking before, after 2010, Dreamers getting organized in a national spectrum, doing lobbying in Washington, sharing their lives, we now have the executive action from President Obama, known as DACA, the Deferred Action, announced in 2012, and renewed in 2014 for these Dreamers. They are temporarily protected. It doesn't give them a residency, a green card, or a path to citizenship, but they're temporarily protected from deportation, and they can get a temporary job permit. But as one of the Dreamers mentioned to me, when he received his job permit, his work permit, was, okay, this feels very good, but it feels like having a blanket, being in the middle of a storm, and being the only person in my family having the blanket. So how can I be okay with this situation? That's what you understand. It doesn't matter whose fault is this. We already had the situation in our hands. And when you talk about one person, you're talking about the whole family. And when you talk about the whole family, you're talking about the whole community. All of us know that we have undocumented people in our communities. As I mentioned before, they may be seated next to our children in school. And we know it. We have known this for a long time. We just have to decide what are we going to do next. We have to make that decision having as much information as possible. And to me, after my experience with this book, the best way to get this information is talking directly to them, asking for their stories.
This is, of course, a complicated situation that has come up over and over in this hour. But there's an interesting irony here, which is that for some of these students, we make it harder for them to go to college, at least financially. And yet, if they can get a college education and become highly employable and well paid, they've transformed themselves into exactly the kinds of immigrants that the U.S. government purports to want to recruit here.
Yes, that's a very interesting point. They are willing to become what the what the American society expect from them, what American society is expecting from a person coming to this country. We have to acknowledge something, that when we are talking about these children and teenagers, we are talking about American people at the heart. I know this may be a little complicated to say, but if you see at the core of this movement, at the core of these people, you'll find the very American essence. Once a person was asking me, how come in your book you talk about an organization where a kid living in a northern state coming from Iran is making friends with a kid living in California coming from Veracruz, Mexico, and they never saw each other before, and they started working together, and it worked. And the reason is because they're not from Iran or from Veracruz or anything. They grew up as an Americans, and they share these values, and they share this idea. And that's the whole thing. I understand this may be a very complex, complicated situation, especially if we step into legal grounds. It's very clear to me after the book, it's even clearer. And what I think we should start doing is just taking a look at what are they at their core? Why are they fighting for this? They're fighting for this because they want to be part of this society, because they want to be fully recognized as that, because they feel that way. America is a very generous country. And when you come as an immigrant legally, this can be a very, very nice way to arrive to this country, because you are going to find a very nice life where mostly you're going to feel welcome. You're going to feel that you have an opportunity. You're going to feel that you have resources. If you make an effort, you are going to have resources to make that effort to grow and to prosper. But what happens if you are not welcome? What happens if you go to a country where every day, at every moment, everything is telling you, we don't want you here, you don't belong here, we don't want you here, go back to your country, go back to your country, you don't belong here, we don't want you here, you're breaking the law, you're an alien. It can be very hard. It's easy to love a country that welcomes you. But I don't know if it's easy to love a country that is rejecting you every step. Well, miraculously, they do love that country. This is a country, this is a society repeating every time, you don't belong, and they still love the country. They love it so much that they are doing a double effort in order to go to college, in order to graduate, in order to get a job, in order to give back to their societies, in order to prove that they belong here. How American is that?
We have an email here from Prithvi, who says, I'm an immigrant who came to the U.S. for higher studies and stayed behind to work legally. Studying here isn't easy, with a higher tuition for international students, jumping through hoops for English proficiency tests and visa interviews. What message are we putting across if the government makes it okay for illegal immigrants to stay and get an education?
I think that we have to rethink the whole spectrum. What message are we sending as a society to the rest of the world if we allow certain population to be part of our own society, in certain jobs, in certain economic structures that we know they're there and they're working in certain areas? But when the moment comes to acknowledge that they are there for other areas that may not be as convenient, we don't want to do it. I don't think the message has to be sent considering political areas or considering what the government is doing or not. I think the message that we have to send is as a society. Is as a society to the rest of the world, as a society of human beings that are saying to the rest of the world that this is the land of the opportunity. We have had these children here for most of their lives. This is the land of the opportunity for what? But the other thing, and sometimes I found people that is just simply refusing to see about to this subject through the social justice and human rights lens. Okay, there's another way to look at it. We, as a society, people who pay taxes have invested in the education of these children at least 12 years. That's our money in there. We're paying for that. Do we want that investment back in Mexico or whatever other country to see what happens? Or we want that investment working for us? If this is the generation, and I mean, we just have to be honest to ourselves here. We are not going to deport 11 million people, right? We simply don't have the money to pay an average of $10,000. That's the estimate that costs a whole deportation process for 11 million people. So we know that at least part of them are going to stay here. And this generation, this young generation, is the one that in the midterm are going to be economically active. And if you allow me, very likely they're going to be paying for the retirement of some of the people that are making the laws now. If they are going to be economically productive and are going to be working to pay for the retirement of this generation, where do we want them? Do we want them working in a fast food restaurant in the shadows, or we want them being doctors, being lawyers, being nurses? I think all of that is part of the message that we have to send right now.
Eileen, I know that you wrote this book initially in Spanish. Did you feel like you had to have it translated into English so that a majority of dreamers could read it easily?
Yes, but mainly the reason why I felt that it has to be translated, it's because the decision on what happens with the lives of these youth is in the hands of American people. It's a very good idea to share the stories in Spanish, and many people are going to feel very close or connected to them. But at the end of the day, I think people that are making the decisions, the one that needs to have the highest amount of information. As I mentioned before, I think everyone has to make their own minds depending of their own experiences, of their own the information that they have on hand. But if I can help to give a little bit more of information on the stories and the facts that I found, well, I think I'm doing something towards that. We need a more just society, and I think that only can come if we have an informed society.
Do you feel like native-born Americans are paying attention to this story, to these stories, in a way that they did not before?
Do you know what I found? Sometimes when I speak to people, the first a thought that may cross through my mind is that this is people that is anti-immigrant or that have a hate speeches, because they may be rough when you talk about certain subjects. But during these months, talking to people, sharing stories, what I've found is that we have a huge lack of information. Unfortunately, media are not giving us the whole picture, because we know we have a media crisis. We have very short stories, breaking stories, but we don't go in depth in certain subjects. Once you start talking or responding to people's questions, and you give a name and a face on numbers and subjects, you can find empathy. And I think at the end of the day, this is a very generous face of the pro-immigrant movement, and people can see that.
The new book by journalist Eileen Truax is called Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Eileen, thank you so much for making the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.